With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we have this week's almond update, and there are only 2 weeks left to sign up for the General Conservation Reserve Program. We'll have more on that. But our top story today, around the nation, this winter was one for the record books. Rod Bain has more.
The warmest winter in the United States on record?
The lower 48, it's coming in with its warmest winter on record. These records go back 130 years all the way to 1895.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says those National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration average temperature numbers for this winter continue a recent trend.
If you look at those 130 years, now all 13 of the warmest winters have occurred since 1990, just in the last 35 years.
Rippey adds the gap between the top two all-time winter average high temperatures are not close from a climate perspective. 0.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
All that occurring despite a very sharp cold outbreak that occurred for about 10 days in the middle of February. But other than that 10 days, the other 90 plus days of winter, it was extremely warm, especially across the northern and the central United States.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Americans are large consumers of seafood despite our need to import most of it, says Drew Winters with Stronger America Through Seafood.
The U.S. is a net importer of food in general. That statistic came out for the first time recently. But the U.S. imports somewhere between 60 and 80% of our own seafood, depending on how you calculate it. And 50% of that is farm raised. So we actually produce very little of our own seafood, and we're getting a big chunk of it from overseas already. But seafood consumption in the U.S. is going up. It's steadily growing, and it will continue to grow, we believe, in the future. So there's a huge market for this and a huge demand, particularly for sustainable, healthy seafoods. And we can do that through aquaculture.
Winters provides insight on how we can expand our seafood supply domestically.
The real key to expanding that is to move into U.S. federal waters. So the U.S. does have an aquaculture industry, but there are no farms in U.S. federal waters right now. The regulatory process is very complex. There are farmers who have been trying to establish operations in federal waters for decades and have been unable to get through the process. So the real key to being able to expand our seafood supply through aquaculture is going to be able to do that in federal waters. And we really need federal legislation. We need clear authority to farm in federal waters, and we need clear pathway through the regulatory process. And SAT, Stronger America Through Seafood, has been advocating for a bill called the Aqua Act in Congress that would do just that.
Thanks to seafood being a sustainable protein and its nutritional benefits, she expects demand to even increase. Farming has become a high-tech business with new digital platforms. CJ Miller reports on one digital farming tool that's on the market to help agronomy consultants.
We're just really excited about putting together a platform that's helping the agronomist bring the best decisions that they can to the grower.
And that's Justin Galliard, Director of Digital Farming with BASF Agricultural Solutions. He's talking about Zarvio Field Manager that's specially designed for agronomy consultants.
The idea here is really to create a platform and a tool that helps them bring the most powerful insights to their growers. Disease is disease, pests are pests. This is a tool that helps to really give an alert of when those diseases are coming into play, and then the agronomist can decide what they want to do about that.
He says Zarvio Field Manager shows and compares data for fields across several different seasons.
Right now we're using satellite imagery to really capture what's happening on the ground level and to really give feedback and use power zones. The power zones are looking at 7 years of history on biomass maps. And the biomass map is where the most productive areas of the field are. So we're able to combine that and give you an immediate look at the history of the field in one day.
For more information about Zarvio Field Manager by BASF, visit Zarvio.com. That's Xarvio.com. I'm CJ Miller.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. With today's National Spotlight, here's Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm at the 2024 Commodity Classic, and I have with me Lance Rezac. And I understand, and I'll congratulate you, Lance, you're the new chair for the U.S. Soy Export Council. I guess the first question would be, how does it feel to get into that position? What does it mean?
It's a little overwhelming, actually. U.S. Soy does so many things in the world in so many places. We've got 150 people working in 82 countries. And so I'm not really responsible. We have great staff. I'm a farmer. I volunteer. They don't have expectations to effort. But we're going to be going to a lot of these countries and just trying to promote all the U.S. soy and talk about our advantages we have, because I was in Brazil recently, and they're going to be the mass volume, cheap producer of soy. I mean, they have unlimited resources. You could use that term easily down there. And so so we got to keep working on promoting our soy advantages that we have here in the U.S.
Well, what makes it so important to have good exports for soybeans?
Well, we actually export 60% of all the soybeans we grow as beans or meal. And if you add in the meat that we export, it's around 65 or 66%. So we're exporting two-thirds of the beans that we grow here. So there's no way, if we didn't have exports, that we could even afford to grow beans. They'd have very little value. And it would be unfair to the rest of the world, too. I mean, they need our protein. We want to be a reliable supplier. We want to have... let them know that we'll be here. The U.S. has some advantages. We can store beans. We can ship them year-round. And we do a lot of work in these developing countries just to help them increase their protein available for their diets.
What's your outlook, or what are your top issues that you want to focus on?
Well, one thing, we obviously got to keep diversifying markets. We got to work in all these other countries. China is the big importer of soy. They import 60% of all soy that's sold in the world. So they get almost two-thirds of the soy in the world, and that leaves a third or 40% for the rest of the countries in the rest of the world. And so we want to make sure we keep diversifying that, because as China, I mean, their population's pretty well peaked, they think. And we have a guy from China here that works for the U.S. Soy Export Council, and he says they are kind of concerned about their economy right now. But he said the government's working on getting that going better. But as China demand slips off and Brazil picks up the supply, we need to make sure we're diversified. And we're not going to abandon China by any means. We need them. They need us. They still need our beans. Brazil can't grow enough. But looking to the future, we need to be looking at other countries to supply them and to make sure we got good demand there.
So what would be one of the most important things you would want growers to know about what you're doing in terms of exports?
Oh, I tell you, I've been on the Soy Export Council for 5 years. This is the beginning of my sixth, and it'll be my last term. And every time I go somewhere or see something, I am amazed at what the U.S. Soy Export Council is doing for farmers around the world. You can be anywhere. Maybe we had a good market in Pakistan, but they got a new president or prime minister or whatever they have in Pakistan, and he said, well, we're not going to buy any GMO stuff now. And so we've been over there working with the poultry producers to say, no, I think they're only feeding about 25% of the chickens they were feeding over there. And so we're working in there, and nobody knows you're doing stuff in Pakistan. I was in Kenya a while back, and we're working with the East Africa Grains Council to try to get GMOs approved there. I mean, we're trying to keep our markets, build our markets. I mean, everywhere you go. And then sustainability, we're working with sustainability. That's kind of one of our advantages. In pretty developing markets where you wouldn't think it'd be important at all. And so my message would be to all farmers, is you would be totally impressed about how well your checkoff dollars are getting used to keep these export markets open, because we're not the low-cost guy in town, and we don't want to be. We got to promote our advantages that we have, and that takes a group to do that, like the U.S. Soy Export Council.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Lance, for taking time to visit with me here. We're at the Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, Rabobank released its first quarter dairy report for 2024. Lucas Fees, a senior dairy analyst for Rabo AgriFinance, says he's cautiously optimistic when describing the U.S. dairy industry.
We've seen now 7 consecutive months of lower milk production, so we're a little bit tighter from the supply side of things. The issue that we're seeing is that this weaker supply is being met by weaker demand as well. So lower milk output, less volume, it's not necessarily creating a overwhelmingly bullish price response like we normally would expect in times of tighter production.
He says the dairy industry is showing a little bit of price recovery.
I do think that because we're tighter on milk supply domestically, and then we're also lower on a global basis, end users are aware of this, and we've seen very slight price recovery in recent weeks. Kind of our theme in this report and looking ahead towards prices this year is one of slow but steady milk price improvement. I don't think we're going back to the, in some cases, record high prices of 2022, but overall, we should see a little bit better margins from a farmer perspective this year than we saw in a challenging 2023.
Dairy exports backed off in 2023 after a fantastic 2022.
We saw exports, especially to a lot of our key trading partners in Southeast Asia or even up into East Asia or China, kind of struggle throughout 2023, not only from purchasing U.S. product, but basically on a global level overall. Granted, that was against a record high 2022, but the backtracking did negatively impact prices a little bit throughout 23.
It's a good news, bad news situation in dairy.
Domestically, too, it kind of depends on the product overall. We've seen pretty strong butter demand, which has kept the butter price firmly elevated of late. But cheese has been more of an issue. And of course, that drives that class three milk price that farmers focus on so much. When I look at the cheese market, we have pretty abundant supply overall. Milk, even though it's down some in the U.S., will continue to flow to cheese plants first. So there's really no negative impact on cheese production because of this tighter milk supply. But on the demand side too, when I talk to clients, when I look at some of the data, it's been a pretty challenging start to the year from a demand perspective.
Again, that's Lucas Feast with Rabo AgriFinance. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Technological advancements, including biotechnology, have been instrumental in driving the significant growth in U.S. agricultural output while reducing inputs. According to USDA, between 1948 and 2021, total agricultural output nearly tripled, while inputs decreased mainly due to innovations in animal and crop genetics, chemicals, equipment, and farm organization. The growth is attributed to increases in total factor productivity, which measures the efficiency of input transformation into output. Biotechnology, particularly genetically engineered seed varieties, has played a crucial role in enhancing productivity by increasing crop yields, lowering pesticide costs, and reducing labor. Traits like herbicide tolerance and insect resistance have led to decreased weeding and tilling needs and reduced insecticide use, contributing to improved productivity and resource efficiency. Time is running out to sign up for the General Conservation Reserve Program from USDA. The sign-up period began March 4th and will run through March 29th. The program offers agricultural producers and private landowners the chance to enroll in long-term conservation practices. The practices include planting approved grasses or trees which can enhance soil health, water quality, and wildlife habitat. CRP also provides a Climate Smart Practice incentive encouraging carbon sequestration and greenhouse gas reduction efforts. Last year alone, producers and landowners enrolled about 926,000 acres in general CRP, bringing the total to nearly 7.8 million acres. Combined with other CRP opportunities, the current total of enrolled acres is nearly 25 million. Anyone interested in general CRP are encouraged to contact their local USDA Service Center for further information and to apply by the March 29th deadline. Garbanzo bean growers in Fresno and Kings counties are dealing with some disease challenges. Agronomy and Nutrient Management Advisor Nick Clark described the issue they were called to investigate.
A couple of weeks ago, Tom Torini, our vegetable crops advisor in Fresno County, was brought some samples and asked to come out to a couple of different garbanzo fields in the Five Points and Lemoore areas near the Naval Base because of some concerns about plants that weren't doing so well, stunted and showing some stems that were dying back and seeing some yellow leaves. And, you know, upon further evaluation, it became pretty clear that these fields were infected with fungus that causes a disease called Ascochyta leaf blight in garbanzos. So This is a pretty serious fungal disease of garbanzos. It's one that affects the above ground portion of the plant. So that would be leaves, stems, and even the pods for the garbanzo beans. It can cause part or all of the plant to die back. It can damage the seeds and cause seeds to become small or even discolored. So there's a yield and potentially quality issue with infection. It's a disease that is favored by cool and wet weather, in particular rain, which we've been having intermittent rainstorms in the area.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture's Pest Exclusion Branch has two vacancies on the Seed Advisory Board. Comprised of 7 seed labelers, 2 seed dealers, and 2 public members, the board oversees seed-related matters under the California seed law. The vacant positions are for a vegetable seed labeler and a public member, each serving a 3-year term from April 1st of this year to March 31st, 2027. Board members who meet at least twice annually are unpaid but reimbursed for necessary travel expenses. Enforcement of the seed law ensures quality seeds in California, with the board advising the CDFA secretary on law enforcement, laboratory diagnostics, and budgetary matters. Individuals interested in being considered for an appointment have until March 22nd to submit a letter of interest and a completed questionnaire to CDFA. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
How much money goes back to the farm from the food you're buying? That's coming up on This Land of Ours. In 2022, farm establishments received 24.1 cents for each dollar spent on food at home and 3.6 cents for each dollar spent on food away from home. These amounts, called the farm shares, highlight the different paths that food takes from farms to consumers' point of purchase, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. Food at home dollars include food purchases from outlets such as grocery stores, supermarkets, and wholesale clubs that are meant to be prepared at home. Food away from home dollars, of course, at restaurants, including delivery and carryout, and other venues where the food is eaten on the premises. The remainder of each food dollar makes up the marketing share, which is the total value of processing, transportation, retailing, and other activities that get food from farm operations to points of purchase for consumers. In 2022, the marketing share was 75.9 cents per food at home dollar and 96.4 cents for food away from home. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. We go back to Chuck Zimmerman with another interview.
I'm visiting with Jim Schertzer with Golden Harvest. So tell me, first of all, a little bit, Jim, what do you do?
So I lead all of our marketing brands from Syngenta Seed, so Golden Harvest being one of those, of course, GHX, and then also NK.
Well, we're at Commodity Classic, a record crowd here this year, so you got a lot of customers coming by, I know. Tell us a little bit about the ways that you are getting your brand, these brands out to your customers, and what does that mean for them?
Yeah, Chuck, that's a great question. You know, we've got a really unique story to tell with all the investment that we've put into not only the brands, but Syngenta Seeds. You think about the investments we've done in R&D. So we've been trying to look for different ways to share that message out for farmers to learn more about those investments and how it's helping them on their farms.
You have some very unique ones. Let's just say NASCAR. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Yeah, we entered a relationship with Sammy Smith. He's a up-and-coming driver in the NASCAR series. This year he's in the Xfinity series, which is the next series below NASCAR. He's with Dale Jr. Motorsports, so we are on his number 8 car. We'll be taking local customers and sellers to these events. We'll use him in some of our promotions. He'll be racing a truck this year as well. We'll have that truck at Farm Progress Show later this year. So it's a really unique experience to tell our story about speed, precision, and power, which is kind of our mantra in R&D, but connect that to a farmer and what that means for them and using racing to do that.
And he knows a little bit about farming now that he's had this experience, I guess you.
Yeah, so that is the fun part of getting involved in some of these type of sponsorships is often you get a chance to teach, for example, Sammy, what farming's all about. And you start to relate how farmers use technology, how farmers use power or speed to do what they do in their operation and how that relates to racing. And we connect those dots. And it's funny to see someone like Sammy get excited about it and actually want to get out and ride in a tractor, get in a combine, et cetera. So.
So other things that you're doing, of course, you have the mobile app for GHX. When it comes to the digital area, that's one, but are there others?
Yeah, the app was we made a big move in this past year of opening that GHX app for anybody as a guest that wants to go on and learn more, download the app. You don't have to have a GHX account with us to go explore all of the digital tools and the way that we're unlocking data to help farmers become more profitable through GHX. So that's a great opportunity for a farmer to enter in and learn more about GHX.
What else would you want the farmers coming through here to know about what you guys are doing in the seed area?
Yeah, so we're going to be, of course, you know, we're at Commodity Classic. We'll be at the other traditional farm shows that maybe farmers like to attend throughout the summer. You'll start hearing us on radio, see us in print, on digital. We've got our John Force Racing partnership, of course, with Sammy. So we're trying to get our brands and our message out there in many ways so farmers can continue to learn more. But the best way is to connect with our local sellers. They're the ones that are, you know, can really help you see not only what our brand's doing, but the products that are right for your farm.
I think that some of your customers have done well in some of the yield contests. Syngenta's helped some of those, right?
Yeah, so we've got a group here, both on soybeans and on corn, some state winners. Some of those soybean yields, I was looking at the sheet the other day, just impressive how much we're getting out of these soybean genetics today. So yeah, we're celebrating them and their success, but it's important. This is important to us, Chuck, because as you think about where the economy is starting to look like from an ag perspective, farm income is going to be compressed. And one of those ways to help buffer that is continuing to push yield and do it in a profitable way. So that's what we're here this week to really share and celebrate with those farmers, them pushing yield in a profitable way for their farms.
And you've got some milestones, legacy brands. NK comes first to mind, of course, I think 140 years, and Golden Harvest at 50. That's got to be worth telling people about.
It is. There's a sense of pride that comes with legacy within brands. As a marketer, it is fun when you've got legacy like that. It's also fun when you have something new like GHX. So we're lucky. We have that balance of something that's new and different, but we've got that foundation with GH, Golden Harvest at 50 years, and you mentioned NK at 140 years, and leveraging that legacy and foundation that those brands have had.
Well, before we close, is there anything else you'd like your customers to know that might be coming by here to say hello?
Well, the one thing is, you know, it's always reminded that spring is right on the doorstep, and just wishing everybody a safe planting season. It, you know, things look like it's shaping up. Could be an early one. Who knows? Mother Nature will dictate that. But, you know, as we get into that spring rush, just everyone be safe.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for taking some time to visit with me here at the 2024 Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
An expert advises us to check out the details of any offer by our tax preparer to give us an instant or anticipated tax refund. Gary Crawford tells us why.
And now, we are talking with those financial wizards Chico and Groucho Marx, and we're talking today about taxes.
Hey, I got an uncle who lives in taxes.
No, taxes, you know, money, dollars.
Dallas, that's where my uncle lives, Dallas, Texas.
Oh, for crying.
Why don't you bore a hole in yourself and let the sap run out?
I agree completely, Groucho. Now, most of us don't like to pay taxes, of course, but it helps if we think we're going to get a refund after we submit our tax forms. However, if you are having a preparer work up your taxes for you, you may have had them in the past tell you that you could get your anticipated refund right then, even before they submit your tax forms to the IRS. That way, you don't have to wait. Huh? But really, it wasn't exactly just giving people instant refunds. They were actually...
Refund anticipation loans. Those are no longer legal.
Loans. Ah, not legal. But Lauren Jones, an Ohio State University Extension consumer policy expert, says the practice, in a way, is still going on, but instead of refund... loans, they are called...
Refund anticipation checks.
Checks. Basically the same thing.
Essentially what these schemes do is if you go in to file your taxes, say in early February, you find out how much your refund's going to be, and the provider will say, rather than owing us any money for having us prepare your taxes, we'll just give you this check that is sort of worth the value of your refund. You get the value of your refund now, and once the government pays your refund, we'll sort of take that money and subtract what you owe us for having done your taxes along with an interest rate.
Interest rates?
The tax preparers are often charging very high interest rates for a very short-term loan. So, you know, if the refund preparer is charging a lot for this service, you can end up paying a huge interest rate on a very short-term loan just to sort of have the cost of your tax preparation paid up front.
And to have your refund money or some of it instantly. Now, back in the days before online submission, it could take several weeks between the time they mailed in your forms until you got the refund. So maybe you really couldn't wait that long. But
now that most of the tax preparation process happens online, the wait between filing your taxes and actually getting the refund is pretty short.
So it really doesn't pay to get a so-called refund anticipation check instantly and pay high interest rates for the convenience when chances are you could have your full refund in as little as 2 or 3 days anyway. Now, not all tax preparation companies charge interest on those instant refunds, but Lauren Jones says you should ask them about their policy on that. Get clear on just what the deal is. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has this week's almond update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer for the Almond Board, Gisette Lewis, joins us today to talk about a recent development that holds some great potential for the almond industry. An announcement was just made about a high rating for a BDO zone in the San Joaquin Valley. And so, Gisette, let's just start there with what exactly that rating is and why it's significant.
Yeah, so the BDO Zone Initiative is a North America-wide program to provide certification and risk rating of feedstock for bio-based industries. And they use technical and standard-based methodologies for determining the rating. So it's a standard method that was developed in conjunction with the national laboratories that work on biomass-based industries. And that consistency of how the rating is calculated really does give industries that are looking for potential building of facilities a consistent methodology and an understanding of the reliability, or the flip side of that, the risk associated with siting a facility in a particular region based on the reliability of that feedstock and the reliability of the other sets of infrastructure that they need in order to make a facility successful.
So that standardized rating being a good one, what does that mean practically for the almond industry?
Well, it means something very positive. I can explain that. So the Almond Board of California has been investing in biomass research and other activities for, I think, about 6 years now. And the goal of those investments by the industry is to diversify and add higher value to the existing markets for the hulls, shells, and the woody biomass from the trees. We really only achieve that goal of getting higher and more diversified value if new industries are located in the Central Valley where that biomass exists and start buying up the hulls, shells, or woody biomass. And that dovetails with the same goals of an economic development agency in the Stanislaus County area called Beam Circular that is funded in part by Stanislaus County. Their goal is economic development as well. So we have a mutual interest in attracting bio-based industries to the valley to buy up some of the almond biomass and also to generate new jobs and new tax revenues and so forth for the county. So we work together to fund this rating. And what it means for both of us is that that rating is now visible to people around the world. The organization that does these, the BDO Zone Initiative, has a network of 5 million subscribers to an online journal that this rating was published in. So 5 million potential companies around the world that are interested in feedstock for bio-based industry. So it achieves raising the visibility to truly an international audience. And it really combines the power of the almond industry and local economic development agencies to raise that visibility, to de-risk these investments, showing that there is a reliable source of high quality biomass in the Central Valley. I think for those of us who live and work in California, that's maybe more obvious. But when many companies around the world think about bio-based industries, they think about, from the ag sector, they often think about the Midwest. They think about corn stover, wheat straw, things that come out of those large row crops. Great example would be corn ethanol that many of us are aware of. They don't necessarily realize how much agriculture there is in California. And in particular, as this rating gave a double A rating, which is only the fifth out of 19 ratings that they've done. So we have a rare double A rating, is really based on that woody biomass, in particular from the almond industry, walnuts, a bit of pistachios, and some fruit trees as well. So it really raises the visibility and it unites the efforts of the almond industry and the region to try to attract companies to consider siting facilities in that region.
So with that rating and making the area maybe a little bit more attractive for investment, that could potentially make for another revenue stream for growers down the road there, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That is the goal, is to bring those more dollars back to the grower. You know, an observation is that the almond kernel, the part that we currently eat and mostly sell, is only about a third of what comes out of an almond orchard every year. The rest are hulls, shells, and some woody biomass. So while we have avenues to put all of those co-products to productive use, sometimes they're not really paying for it. You know, shells and the woody biomass, it either gets hauled away for free, or in the case of the trees, if you're in the San Joaquin Valley and you can no longer burn them, it actually costs growers quite a bit of money to dispose of those trees through whole orchard recycling. So looking for more diverse uses of those co-products will either directly add money back to the grower, perhaps defraying more of the cost of hulling and shelling, as those co-products have higher value, or in the case of the trees, for example, finding alternative uses than just relying on whole orchard recycling.
So definitely quite a bit of potential there. And now you've touched on it briefly, being a collaborative effort to get this project moving, but who else has been instrumental in working through this process?
Yeah, I think the primary partners are Stanislaus County themselves. They invest in Beam Circular, and then Beam Circular, which is a nonprofit, also has some additional resources that they can bring to bear. So the three of us working together are able to get this off the ground, and that's a partnership that I anticipate continuing to grow as the county, together with Beam Circular, really implement their vision for a circular bioeconomy in that region. We also hope in the coming year to do this with the Fresno region as well. We've already been in contact with an economic development agency down in Fresno County, a very big part of the almond growing region, and look forward to hopefully replicating this rating and hopefully, again, raising the visibility internationally as to the reliability, the quality, the really strong infrastructure that we have for almond biomass or almond co-products, as well as affiliated tree industries as well. So we hope that this is the first of at least two of these in the state.
So sort of laying the groundwork there for other areas to look at in the state. And now this project is part of kind of a larger effort, right?
Yeah, I think it's really one very important step of many in partnering with research institutions, education institutions, and regional economic development agencies to look at how we can come together to both raise the visibility and de-risk investment in these types of industries that really add value to not just agriculture, but to the rural economy, both in terms of new jobs, maybe some higher quality jobs, and preparing the workforce for those opportunities and really attracting the investment to put those facilities in. So it's part of a longer-term strategy, but one that already starting to see some small steps forward, not just this, but some new companies that we know are going to be building some pilot facilities, manufacturing based on almond co-products. And so we hope that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And it seems like a smart strategy to pull some resources to make an investment to show the viability to attract some large-scale investment from folks that might not do all the homework necessary to find out some of this information on the feasibility of biomass in these areas.
That's right. And while the Almond Board has some funds and we have a good understanding of our co-products that we generate in the industry, you know, we can't answer questions about what kind of permits are needed to site a facility, where potential locations are, where they have access to the highway infrastructure or rail infrastructure, a lot of nuts and bolts kinds of questions that a company would need in order to make the decision to build a new manufacturing facility. So those partnerships are really important to answer all the kinds of questions that a company would have as we try to attract them to expand this circular bioeconomy in the Valley.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Dairy producers have until April 29th to enroll in the USDA's Dairy Margin Coverage Program for this year. Rod Bain reports.
Sign up is now underway for dairy producers desiring USDA dairy margin coverage for 2024.
Dairy margin coverage helps producers with assistance when the price of milk and the cost of feed fall below a certain level.
Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau says dairy growers have until April 29th to apply for DMC at their local FSA office. As for the significance of this Farm Safety Net program to producers,
it's a really affordable risk management tool. And based on what we saw last year as we were coming up to the normal enrollment period, some producers were looking at it and maybe not seeing the value in it. And those that did actually reaped the benefit for a good part of 2023. So we really hope producers take a look at this valuable tool and take advantage of the opportunity to have an affordable risk management strategy at their disposal.
In fact, the administrator says enrolled producers may receive DNC payments for January 2024 if triggers are reached by the first week of March.
The coverage is retroactive, so the payment eligibility could certainly be for producers that have qualifying margins with respect to this program.
One notable change in the voluntary dairy margin coverage for this year, a one-time adjustment to base production history. Administrator Ducheneau says smaller-sized dairy growers who previously had supplemental DMC coverage over the past 3 years can combine that production history to create one adjusted base production history for DMC coverage purposes.
For 2024 DMC enrollment, dairy operations can use the established supplemental production history for coverage years 21 through 23 and combine the supplemental production history with established production history for one adjusted base history.
He adds that in addition to the online dairy decision tool available at dmc.dairymarkets, all one word, .org, dairy producers considering DMC coverage need to speak with staff at their local FSA offices soon to learn more information and determine best coverage for them.
Because they're going to know your situation and the actions that you took in previous years and be able to convey it to you in a way that matters.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.